You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Dave Hodges is as mad as hell, and he's not gonna take it anymore.
I'd like to help you talk to you if I really would, but the din in my head, it's too much and it's no good. I'm standing in a window tunnel, shouting through the roar, and I'd like to get the information, asking for me what blood makes noise. It's ringing in my ear, blood makes noise, and I can't really hear you in the thickening of fear.
Common sense is not so common. This is the Common Sense Show with Dave Hodges.
Good Sunday evening, everybody, and welcome to another exciting edition of the Common Sense Show. Hi, everybody. My name is Dave Hodges, and I am the host of this show. And we just passed a milestone this last week, our 10th year anniversary. We're really, really glad we're still around. I mean, that could be in jeopardy. Wait till you hear what we're going to talk about tonight. But before we get to that, I want to let you know that show, and without these good people, it would be hard to bring you this show every week. We come to you live on Global Star Radio Network, which is a tremendous network with some great programming, including our friends the Hagmans and Ted Brower, and on and on and on it goes. So we just have a great network behind us. We're also airing on Red State Talk Radio, and absolutely love that. And, you know, Paul Preston is, I believe, the top draw over there, and you've heard Paul on this show quite a bit. We're very good friends and share intel all the time. So, and then we'll go out to a number of stations and hi to our friends out at KYAH, and heard from a few of you this week. It's always good to hear from the good people of Utah. So anyway, welcome to all of you. I want to let you know that the good people that bring us this show, we are going to talk about three of them here right in the intro before we get started in this terrific show tonight. Steve Quayle, Renaissance Precious Metals. Look, it's a matter of time, folks. I mean, the fiat currency is going up in smoke. I caught the other night, I came home, I turned on the news late, and I was doing channel surfing, and I saw the old Cheech and Chong movie, Up in Smoke. And I turned to my wife, and I said, you know what? That's the banks. That's what's going to happen to our money. So you got to take your money and go somewhere with it. You got to do something with it, not just leave it there for them to steal. Well, Steve Quayle gives you options, low-pressured informational options. Give him a call tomorrow at 406-586-4842, 406-586-4842. And it's really important that you tell him Dave Hodges sent you. Yeah, Steve and I are good friends, but he'll take care of anybody that calls. But I'm just telling you, tell him Dave Hodges sent you for the royal treatment. We're also brought to you by HealthMasters.com, and you just heard Dr. Ted's show. And you know the story, my back, my meniscus in my knee. Excuse me. I don't go to the doctor first. I go to Dr. Ted, and that's the truth. In fact, you heard me tell the story here on the air. He's in Greece, and I got a ruptured disc in my back, and I'm cussing his name because I don't know how to get a hold of him. He comes home, and 2 days later, I'm okay and standing upright. Now I'm fully functional. No surgery for the boy. So healthmasters.com, and he's got a coupon code set up for our listening audience. And that coupon code is 5. That's the number 5, Hodges. That's healthmasters.com. And then finally, we're brought to you by Numana. And after you hear all 3 hours tonight, I'm warning you. Well, let me put it this way. I don't want to warn anybody. I want to speak from the positive. Food, water, guns, gold, ammo, and medicine is what you need. Numana is going to give you the food, the very best durable food company in the world. And I really, really hope you take advantage of the offer that they have right now. They've slashed some prices. They're trying to move inventory at the end of the year. This is a great, great time, and everybody needs 6 months to a year of storable food. And a lot of people feel that's the minimum. How do you get yours? Well, go to numana.com/Hodges and use Hodges9 as the coupon code to take 5% off for our audience. Again, that's numana.com/Hodges. Well, that takes care of the business, and thanks so much for the good people that support this show. In the third hour, we're going to be joined by my very good friend, Bob Griswold, of Ready Made Resources, and we got a number of scenarios we're going to talk about, because this thing called the holiday season, I don't want to rain on anyone's parade, But things could turn south very quickly in a multitude of ways. And Bob and I are going to talk about that. We're going to explore some things. We spoke yesterday, and I don't think an hour is enough. And an hour is not enough for my first guest, Cody Snodgrass. Cody, well, I'm going to let him introduce himself to you, but he's got some experience. He knows about black ops. He knows about CIA. He knows about false flags. And he is very, very well connected with people who know what he doesn't, that tell him what they know. And I'm telling you, folks, it's going to be a wild ride these next 2 hours. You better strap yourself in, you know, buckle up, because there's going to be some earth-shattering revelations coming. And that's all I'm really, and I'll tell you honestly, too, some of this stuff is upsetting. And if you got the small kids in the room, and I haven't issued this warning for a long time, but tonight is the night. Get them out of the room, because this is going to be tough stuff. Cody, my friend, welcome to the show. This is your first time on the show. We are so glad to have you. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's a privilege. We've listened to you guys for years, and you're a tireless worker. You've really dug out some good truth and stories, and it's just a real privilege to be here, sir.
Well, it's the honor is all ours for what you are doing now for your country and for humanity. But we're in for a wild ride. But for those who may not be really familiar with you, I know some people are because you've been interviewed on this network on Global Star. But for those who didn't catch that, tell the listening audience about your background, and let's just start from there and work our way forward.
Okay. Before we do that, I always make a statement about the 1982 Intelligence Identities Protection Act. That's the IIPA. It's U.S. Code Title 50, Sections 421 and 426, and it states that disclosure of a U.S. government operative's identity is illegal only if it is done intentionally and with knowledge that the government is still actively maintaining a cover for such operative. And that way, you know, I don't want to let any names slip. Some of the guys we're talking about will be dead or inactive, and the ones that are operational, we don't use their name, and that... That came from the case in January of 2013 when CIA case officer John Kerouac was sentenced to 30 months in federal prison when he was exposing the CIA's RDI program, the retention, detention, rendition, detention, and intelligence thing for Gitmo. And so he let a name slip, and they canned him. So we're not going to do any of that. And we're going to do all this right and in a good way. And so, okay. My background began in the story here. It goes back to 1974. I graduated from R.L. Turner High School in Farmers Branch, Texas. And I took the SAT test in physics and scored in the top 1% in the whole United States. And I was also number one on the tennis team and scored number one on the Marine Corps physical fitness test thing. And so I got a full tennis scholarship to college. And in 1975, in the fall semester at East Texas State University, I was approached by a professor, and he said, there's a CIA recruiter down here, and he wants to talk to you all alone. And I went down there, and I told him that they tried to recruit me for the CIA then. And I said, why? You know, and they said, it's your test scores, you know, top 1% of the U.S. Well, I turned down recruitment because I'd already been at that time working with some Vietnam veterans who were training me. They got back from the war, and a couple of them worked for the agency over there. And so throughout the rest of the time in college, I was actually working with them. And so I graduated with a double bachelor of science degree in both mathematics and physics, and then I went to work on my master of science degree in physics at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. And while we were there, we had a behind-the-scenes tour at NASA down in Houston and got to... fly the space shuttle simulator, which the one the astronauts train on, is a real privilege to do that. And so after graduate school, I worked for Chevron Geosciences and then moved up to Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was a petroleum and research geophysicist for Amoco Production Company. But that was just my civilian front. You know, it's like a NOC, non-official cover. And during that time, about from 82 on through 85, we were actually engaged over in Arkansas during the CIA Operation Centaur Rose. There's actually three of them over there, but I was in Centaur Rose, and that was the one where they were arming the Contras down there. Reagan and them had passed the Boland Amendment in 84, Reagan went around them and got CIA to start doing that. We can talk about all that later. That's a whole other thing. And so you fast forward through the 80s. I was hired to bodyguard Barry Sadler. He was a staff sergeant, did two tours in Nam, Special Forces. They trained with the 20th Special Forces Group 63 back in 63 with Barry Seal and some other guys. And then they went to Vietnam, and he in 65, he's in the Highlands in Pleiku and, stepped on a bungee stick, and then he wrote The Battle of the Green Beret in at the Subic Bay Medical Facility. That was the number one hit back then, but in the country. But I was hired to bodyguard him later on, and that whole story's in the book. It's never been out, in public much. And we were right in the middle of all that. And so then you fast forward into 1991. I was in Project Slammer, and we can talk about all that later. It's an amazing thing. But I died twice. I was targeted for assassination. We were in operations, very sensitive operations, and several people lost their lives. One of them was the son of a CIA agent active in Bangkok, Thailand. And then they inadvertently blamed his son's death on me, so they targeted me. I survived that. I died twice in the hospital. They had to shock me back and everything. And by that time, I was getting operationally ineffective. I had many broken bones and fractured vertebrae, nerve damage, head injuries, and so forth. And so it took me a long time to recover from that near-death experience. And so later, in 1994... in October, one of the contractors, his name is Harold Leonard, and I say his name because he's deceased now, and he called me, and we went to meet out in a wooded area. It was under tree cover. He's always worried about satellites and stuff. And we went out there, and he had a black and purple backpack. It had $500,000 in cash in it, and he said, "We've got a job for you." And I said, "What country are we going?" Saudi Arabia, because we'd had previous jobs over there for $50,000 a month with the Saudi royal family, bodyguarding their kids and stuff, and I figured we're going back over there. And he said, "No, it's here in the States." And I said, "Well, what kind of job is it?" And he said, "It's an EOD job, explosive demolition." I said, "What's the target?" He said, "It's a building." I said, "What kind of building?" He said, "It's a federal building." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, it's a federal building." I said, "Which one?" He said, "It's the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building." And I told him I had severe PTSD by this time, and I had been drinking heavily to cover my PTSD. And, I had bad dreams, and I was waking up kicking and stuff. And so I told him, I said, "Look, you guys have went too far this time. There is no way I'm going to do this. You guys are crazy, and I want nothing else. I want out. I'm done." And that right there is the point where I turned from an asset to a liability. And 2 days later, my handler called me. His name was Duke Flaglier. He's deceased now of Agent Orange cancer. He had also done two tours in Vietnam with Barry Sadler and all of them. He called me and he said, "You need to leave the country." And I said, "I'm not going to say a word. I'm done. I'm out." And he goes, "No, you don't understand. You have operational knowledge now. This operation is going to come off sometime, so you need to go." And I didn't take his advice. He had keys to a place in Belize. He said I could go down there, and then they'd stage me from there out somewhere else. And so anyway, I stayed here, and then you fast forward into April 19th of 1995. That's the day when the Murrah Building went up. And make a long story short, when that happened, I didn't know the date when it was going to happen, but I went immediately back, and we have fake IDs and passports and drop cars and all the stuff for tradecraft. And so I went back down to Oklahoma between Tulsa and Oklahoma City. We had some old safe houses that were there from the operations in Arkansas back in the 80s. So it was Centaur Road. And I can tell you all about that later and how we moved the arms and all the crap there. But anyway, so I went out of the country for a little while and came back. By that time, they'd indicted McVeigh and Nichols. And so some time went by, and then in 1997, the ATF and DEA began a joint operation in Colorado Springs, Colorado, called Operation Stingray. And that operation, there was a guy who's going to be later the nation's top cop, Vice President Al Gore, and Janet Reno would give him the nation's top cop award. His name was ATF Agent Blake L. Butler. And I would find out later that Blake Butler had been at the Waco compound on the day it was hit, and he was also up at the Randy Weaver Ruby Ridge, Idaho fiasco, and that he was also working at the Murrah building the same day it was bombed, but he magically called in sick. So, me and Blake Butler had been engaged. I was selling guns to him. I had the biggest machine gun shop here in the state of Colorado called Scientific Systems. We had Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 NFA, National Firearm Act, licenses. We could manufacture suppressors, build machine guns. We worked on a lot of the cops' guns, some DEA guns, and stuff like that. So I was the biggest dealer here in the state from 91 to 93. And so later on in 97, I was selling legal guns, no problem, everything legal. And then you fast forward to April the 20th of 1999. That was the day the Columbine High School shooting was here. That was the biggest high school shooting in history of the U.S. up in Littleton, Colorado. And so Bill Clinton and Janet Reno, who was the U.S. attorney, and we'll talk about more about her later because some of my associates worked with her in No-Knock Narcotics down in Dade County, Florida. But anyway, they all came into town to capitalize on the political gun thing, you know. And on April 22nd of 99, they were on TV, and I was sitting there with Agent Butler, and they had an ATF house there. It was an undercover residence, and I didn't know it. And they had 4-millimeter hidden cameras there. And across the street was ATF DEA surveillance residence for the undercover resident. And so Bill Clinton and them were on TV, and he said, what do you know about them? So I started blabbing my mouth, and I talked about CIA, TV file rings in Arkansas, drugs and arms, cocaine, the whole thing. I ran my mouth. And so what happened later was that ATF agent, at behest of the CIA, they planted me with evidence. CIA took the tapes and disappeared them because they were highly inflammatory. And it's the stuff we're going to talk about here later tonight. And so then ATF agent Butler planted me with fake evidence. He went to the, they lied to the grand jury in the 10th Circuit Court, and they placed me in front of Judge Edward Nottingham. And Judge Edward Nottingham had been nominated to his position by none other than ex-director Central Intelligence George Bush Sr. Well, the prosecutor they put on me was United States Attorney Tom Strickland. And Tom Strickland had been appointed by Bill Clinton. And so Strickland had been in a law firm in Denver, Brownstein, Hyatt, Faber, and Strickland, and he quit that job to become U.S. attorney just a few days after the Columbine shooting. And we found out later that Norman Brownstein, the principal partner of the law firm, had also worked for this Council of Six, the CIA's Council of Six attorneys, back in the 70s when George Bush Sr. was director CIA. So the fix was in here in the 10th Circuit. That's why they sent McVeigh up there for the trial and everything. So we're going to get into all that later. I'm going to run this down quickly, and then we can go to questions. After this, when I went in there, the CIA picked me up, and they asked me direct questions about President Clinton. And then they dropped me off at the Colorado Springs Airport to the ATF, DEA, IRS. And so anyway, after all that, Judge Nottingham denied my bond. I had a perfect record, not one traffic ticket, no drugs, no violence, nothing. And he said no bond under any condition, and they threw me in supermax solitary confinement three cells down from Timothy McVeigh, who had already been there. He was waiting for his execution day by lethal injection up at the Terre Haute, Indiana FCI. That's the Federal Correctional Institute. And so we were all in there together. And now while we were there, they sent in a guy named Kerry James Gagan. And the story I'm going to tell about him comes up. He was given a van load of C4 by his CIA handlers, a whole van load, to drive from Denver to Trinidad, Colorado, 3 days before the Murrah building was bombed. He was to drive into his contacts. He did not know the contacts, which is standard compartmentalization, you know, for black ops procedure. And the three men he met were Middle Eastern men. And they had plans to the Murrah building in English, and he saw them. And he got spooked. He drove back to Secret Service in Denver. He thought he was going to be a patsy or something, told them the story. CIA got wind of it. They planted his house. FBI put him in there right with us. So So it was Gagin and me and Nichols and Tim McVeigh and all the people that had any operational knowledge of the Patsy operation, okay? And so after all this, they sent Timothy McVeigh to be executed on June 11, 2001, and I talked to several people that talked to him. We'll get into all that later because a lot of people always want to know about that stuff. And so I went 4 years and never had a motions hearing. All the hearings were sealed. They kicked the court transcribers out. It was all sealed. And so after 4 years, Nottingham gave a motions hearing date of July 24th, 2003. And by that time, we'd hired a tape expert. His name is William Valentine. He was a CIA bugging, debugging expert. He had had coffee in the White House in the Oval Office with Clinton, Bush, and Reagan. And his job was to bug and debug the White House, the Oval Office. So we hired him as a tape expert, and we had 100% legal proof that the ATF and DEA had tampered with the tapes and committed perjury to the grand jury and obstructed justice and so forth. And so then, 2 weeks before that hearing, on July 7th, 2003, I was cleaning my car, the windshield in the parking lot, 8th Street Walmart, Colorado Springs, and I never saw it. I only heard it. I was leaned over the hood cleaning my car just before we were going to go in and take down the whole ATF and DEA office and get them all thrown in prison. We had the evidence. And here comes a car. I never saw it. I heard a motor racing and the wheels squealing, and it totaled my Crown Victoria LTD out from under me. It knocked it about 6 to 8 feet straight back in the parking lot. It was a motor off, emergency brake set. And it knocked me back into another car. I hit the top of the car and rolled off the hood into a fender of another car, bounced off the passenger side fender and hit a concrete lamp pole. And my doctor told me, you're extremely lucky to be alive. So I was in the hospital for a while. I got out. This is just before the hearing on July 24th. I was leaving a physical therapy outpatient facility on West Colorado Springs, and I was walking with a cane. And I went out to my other car, and sitting out in the parking lot on the road, there was a Colorado Springs police cruiser with a motor running. And so when I got around to my car to open the door, they floored it, and it jumped the curb, sent sparks everywhere, and this car was coming right at me. And so it turned sideways and threw dirt and stuff all over me, and sitting in it was the nation's top cop, ATF agent Blake Butler, dressed in a Colorado Springs police uniform, and he shook his finger at me about 4 feet away, you know, threatening me not to go to court. So I went back home. I went and threw up for a while, and I was really upset. I went back home. So I got back home that night, and me and my wife and young son were in here watching a movie, and someone pulled up in the front yard. This is days before this big hearing. And I looked out the window there, and it was none other than Harold Leonard, the guy that had offered me the job to blow up the Murrah building for $1 million in cash back in October 94. So I didn't want my son to see his father get shot. I figured they were just going to kill me, and I didn't care by that point. I just went out there, and I'd rather be killed by one of my op buddies, you know, than some stranger. So I went out there, and he had an SUV, and he had his motor running with his hands on the wheel. He rolled the window down, and he said, we've been ordered to kill you, and if you ever talk or talk about this in court or talk anything about Oklahoma City or any of the ops we pulled, we've been ordered to kill you. And he pointed up at my house, and he said, we've got orders to kill your wife and kid, too. And then he put his head down on the steering wheel, and he took a big sigh, because Harold was just like me. He was worn out. The light's all crushed out of your soul after you do those black ops, if you can survive, you know. And we were both wrecked. We both had PTSD, and we both been drinking heavily anyway. And then he looked at me, Dave, and he said, it's nothing personal. So he drove off, and I called my attorney, Harvey Steinberg. He was the Denver Broncos club attorney at the time, the football team. And I changed my plea. I said, look, I just got to plead guilty to something. I don't care what it is. So we met Greg Goldberg up at the 10th Circuit Court in Denver. And Greg Goldberg said, look, we're getting a lot of heat on this case. He said, there's something real funny going on with this case, and I don't want anything to do with it. Just pick a charge, any charge. I don't care which charge. And you're out of here. So I pointed to an indictment he had in his hand. I didn't even know what it was, and I didn't care. And it was dealing firearms without a license, which is really a little deal. So I pled guilty to that, and I got out and did my supervised release. And so I made up my mind that one day when Bill Clinton got out of office and Hillary Clinton, you know, she was Secretary of State, I'm so glad she didn't be elected president because I wouldn't be coming forward now. But I've got this new book out. It's almost 700 pages. It's all detailed with, you know, everything. It's got police reports, records, 302s from the activity logs of the ATF and DEA and so forth. And I've got all kinds of evidence. We snuck tape. I went in to the U.S. Attorney's Office on May the 2nd, 2001, about 1 p.m., and I snuck surveillance equipment, Dave, past all the x-ray stuff, past all their security. It's really high in the United States Attorney's Office. And I secretly tape recorded them in there. And these tapes have never been made public. And I have the nation's top cop in there asking me if I work for the CIA. They ask me all kinds of things. So I've got proof of a lot of this stuff that I'm saying. So that's the basic timeline. You know, from the Murrah building to turning that job down and then talking about it later, then they planted me with evidence. They planted Kerry James Gagan with evidence. Judge Nottingham ordered him to go to the Nut Hut in Springfield, Missouri, the FCI, Federal Correctional Institute, there where they have a medical and mental facility. He was never seen again. McVeigh was executed. Nichols got life in prison. He's down here at the Florence FCI Correctional Facility in Florence, Colorado, doing life without parole. And I'm the last one. I'm the only one out. I'm the only one that can talk right now about this. So any questions, anything, I'm ready to go. And I thank you for this opportunity, sir. The American people need to hear this truth. I've kept it quiet for 22 years.
Well, no longer. It's going to be out in the open. And I just got a message from one of our regular listeners, and they were saying, the moment I said your name, the audio dropped for a few seconds. So be prepared. I mean, this could be a wild ride, technologically speaking. Anyway, what I'd like to start with is just something out of my own personal curiosity. McVeigh, was he Lee Harvey Oswald in this? Was he just a patsy who had nothing to do with it, or was he part of it and then he was held out as the patsy?
Yeah. It's hard to tell. Answer that without talking about Waco, because a lot of people don't know he was there at Waco.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to backtrack to Waco a little bit and go through that, and then I'm going to answer that question about the patsy. He was a patsy, but he was an unknowing patsy. So just follow with me here, and we'll go through the brief history. Now, all this is detailed in high detail in the book, but I knew a guy named Ron Cole. And Ron Cole was a Branch Davidian. I am not a Branch Davidian, but he was. And he was one of David Koresh's best friends. And just before the compound was hit on February 28th of 1993, where four ATF agents were dead and six of the Branch Davidians were killed in that initial shootout, just before that date, Ron Cole's mother in Florida got sick. Now, Ron Cole told me this stuff straight to my face. I was not at the Waco compound, but this is a straight eyewitness account. And so he went down to Florida to take care of his mother, and the very next day, the feds hit the place. ATF hit him on February 28, 93. He heard it on the news, and he called McVeigh on the phone before the feds cut the phone lines. And McVeigh had just been shot in the shootout and was bleeding and had not lost consciousness. So Ron said, "Man, what is going on? I heard stuff on the news." And McVeigh told him, he says, the feds showed up in white cattle trucks. They had trailers they were pulling behind, and the Branch Davidian dogs ran out and started barking at them. And the feds shot them. The ATF shot them and then opened up on the compound. And so Koresh and them returned fire, and that's when he got hit. And so Ron heard all this, and then the phone line got cut. And then the feds set up a perimeter, so Ron immediately left, found someone to take care of his mom, and he came back. By that time, there was a big perimeter, and the Branch Davidians that were there, they were supposed to be in the compound. A lot of them were out shopping at Waco and running errands and so forth, so they weren't there. And the Fed had set up a big perimeter, and so all the Branch Davidians gathered around, and they got tents and binoculars, telescopes, and they were at the perimeter fence camping, watching what was going on. And during the night, Ron Cole said they saw some strange things. There were black helicopters, no markings, no lights. And they were circling the Branch Davidian compound at night, and they were seeing lights come down, thin lights. All these guys were civilians, you got to remember, Dave. They hadn't been in the military. And what they were seeing, green and orange and red, and they didn't know what it was. And they thought it was strange. And they were saying, gosh, I wish we had some night vision. I wish we had something. And some guy walked up out of the darkness. He says, I've got some military night vision. He says, that's machine gun fire. Those are M60 machine gun tracers. He goes, I was in Desert Storm. I just got back from the war in 91, and I saw that those ops at night. And Ron Cole took the night vision. He said, who are you? And he said, I'm Timothy McVeigh. So they shared their night vision, and they watched. And McVeigh explained the Army tactics of what was going on. Because at that time, there was a perimeter of all the feds around it, and it's a standard Delta Force or an Army tactic that when you have shooters in a conventional structure like the Branch Davidian compound, you deny the high ground to them. Okay, so the snipers that are up on the roof can have a long-range shot, but if you push them down with machine gun fire to the lower parts of the building, then they can't shoot as far, and you can collapse the perimeter. Okay, and so that's what they were doing. And so McVeigh was there with them explaining all this to them while they were murdering the Branch Davidian. And then later on April 19th of 1993, that supposed fire broke out, and 54 were dead, 21 children among them, and then Ron Cole went off, and there's another story about him going to Canada and everything. We'll get to that later. But anyway, to make a long story short, McVeigh was there, and he saw what the carnage and what was really going on, which kind of pissed him off. And then another thing a lot of people don't know is that when he went over to Desert Storm, you know, he was an M1A1 Abrams tank commander. Nichols was his platoon commander there. He went a Bronze Star, and he had confirmed kills there. And so he had actually been given his anthrax shots and all his stuff, which we're going to talk about later as the real reasons why they bombed the Murrah building for the Gulf War syndrome. But he had also been given a secret injection. What was happening, they were using soldiers as covert testing for the Lockheed Martin satellite system. It's called the BEAST. It's the Battle Engagement Area Simulator Tracker. And what this was a real-time satellite function to observe infantry people on the ground in smoke and oil well fires and sand and so forth. And they gave McVeigh a chip, a little microchip in his butt, and he didn't know about it until later when the protein coat broke down and his autoimmune response kicked in and he started getting sores and everything. So when he got back from Desert Storm, he had his chip removed, and it really pissed him off that the Army had done that to him. And we know this because we have letters that he wrote to his sister Jennifer. Jennifer was called later to testify at his trial in the Tenth Circuit, and the FBI had kicked her door in and confiscated most of these letters. We have copies of them in the book in the appendix where he tells her about the microchip and everything. And so anyway, when McVeigh got back to the States, got that microchip out, he went to Special Forces. He wanted to be a soldier. And so he went, and his class and training class, there was over 100 people there, and do the psych profiles. The CIA picked him and 10 other guys out of the class. They got his CO, and they had a secret meeting, just like they did with me. They had a secret meeting, and they said, we need guys to bomb buildings, move drugs, do assassinations. You go ahead and finish Special Forces, and that's going to be your front. See, they call that an OCO. That's an official cover operative. His official cover would have been Special Forces. And the Special Forces guys wouldn't have known what he was really doing for CIA. And McVeigh told him, just like me, I don't want to work for you. I don't want to do this. And he quit, and he went up to Calspan. That's a defense contractor up in Buffalo, New York. And he was working there as a security guard. And that's the time we believe he was approached by CIA to bomb the Murrah building as a patsy. And it's a standard program they have of alienation and isolation, where they take a guy that's been in the military and he comes back to the civilian world and he's all bored, and they offer him something. But he had motivations. He didn't like the CIA using the special forces for front. He was more or less a patriot for that. He didn't like being microchipped like a dog without his permission. And he certainly didn't like them murdering the Branch Davidians. That was flat out murder down there. They machine gunned them up at night, night after night after night. They flew over that compound and just machine gunned it up to Swiss cheese. And most of the people were already dead by the time they hit it. You know, on April 19th, 1993, that's 2 years before the Mirabelling went up. And so he was watching our military. They lied to Governor Ann Richardson down there to get the tanks off of Fort Hood. My stepdad, he took his training there at Fort Hood before he went over to Pearl Harbor and Pacific Command. And so anyway, this whole thing was going on. And then McVeigh was the patsy for the job, okay? He was an unknowing patsy. And it was some kind of umbrella op where they have two parallel ops. If I had taken that job to bomb that, I'd never do it for $1 million. I would have charged 20 or 50 million to do something like that. But I was patriotic, and I can't do that to our people. I just can't. And that's why I titled this book, Choosing the Light. So McVeigh was the patsy. Then they had a parallel op where they were wiring the building internally. And McVeigh was going to be the cover for the black op, because the Murrah Building's a big thing. You can't keep that quiet. I mean, there's going to be civilian press. I mean, it killed 168 people. It injured over 680. There were 324 buildings damaged around a 16-block radius. Shattered glass in 258 buildings. It destroyed or burned 86 cars and cost about $652 million in damages. And so you can't cover that up. You have to have a cover for that kind of an op, and he was the cover. And I think they were going to just, you know, detonate both those devices, the ones in the building and then his little Ryder truck thing, all at the same time and use that as a cover. But the problem happened, and two bombs in the building didn't go off, and we can talk about all the details about that later. But the thing about this is that McVeigh did have motivation against the U.S. government after what they did to him, microchipping him and then murdering the people down at Waco. That was flat-out murder. They violated Posse Comitatus Act, and I can tell you the rest of the story about Ron Cole, which is amazing. There's so much to this stuff that people don't know, and I've got firsthand. I mean, I talked to these guys firsthand, and so anyway, McVeigh was a patsy, and he was an unknowing patsy.
And you know, I'd like to visit the McVeigh thing. Just so, let me take a side turn here, because here's something.
Sure.
I got to tell you, this has sat with me ever since the event. With my own eyes, I saw this on TV. I heard it with my own ears. I remember shortly after the bombing, they issued an alert, and there were two things that I saw that I want you to comment on. One was, we are looking for a John Doe number one and a John Doe number two, and they gave the description as a Middle Eastern man. And then here in Phoenix, on Channel 12, one of our local affiliates on TV, I was watching the news, and I've since confirmed this with other people, like, was I asleep, drunk, or what that night when I heard this? But they played a grainy video of surveillance camera that they had gotten from NBC, and it showed McVeigh a few days before the bombing sitting with a man of Middle Eastern descent. And, you know, I went back to the John Doe number one and John Doe number two. Is there anything to this? Can you comment on these two events?
Absolutely. What I have in this book is stuff that's never, ever been made public by anybody. And I'll tell you what it is. The night before the bombing, this was April 18th, McVeigh and some of these Middle Eastern guys you're talking about, they showed up at a strip club. We call them titty bars. It was a strip club on Sheridan and 21st Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, the reason I know this is because I'm part Cherokee Indian and part white. One of my Cherokee medicine men, women, had a daughter. Her name was Norma Freedom, and her daughter's name was Shannon. And Shannon was a dancer at that club. And so McVeigh and some Middle East, there were two of them with him, they came in and they were drinking and partying. And one of those Middle Eastern guys was real loud and drunk, and he was bragging. We'll be real important here pretty soon. Well, Shannon was there sitting with him, and she got kind of spooked. And she went and told the bouncers and everything. This is direct eyewitness testimony. I mean, Shannon's I know all of them real good. And so, anyway, some other girls started messing with the guys, and then they left. And no one thought much about it until the next day when they started putting out the things you're talking about, you know, the John Doe number one, John number two. Then later on, when McGay's face was blown all over the news down there, these girls saw it, and they said, oh, my God, that guy was here. Well, see, this didn't fit with the federal cover story. So what happened right after that, one of the girls, I've got her name in the book, that was sitting with McVeigh and these two Middle Eastern guys, she had an apartment there in Tulsa. And that very next day, someone went in there and murdered her in her apartment.
Mm.
Okay, she was a witness. I got her name. And then they the feds came in that club and confiscated the video footage out of that club. It was called Lady Godiva's. That was the name of the club. And I know the owners. I know that some of the dancers. I've got friends all over Tulsa. One of them is Craig Roberts, you know, that Tulsa police detective that did the wonderful investigative work about the Oklahoma City bombing. You know, the feds wanted him to burn all his files and shred them and everything. And so anyway, this is a story no one's ever heard. But we have direct, I mean, eyewitness accounts of them in this place the day before the bombing. And the whole federal cover story about the lone bomber and the whole thing, it's all lies. So anyway, yeah, the thing about the John Doe is perfect. And Kerry James Gagan, Dave, I talked to him directly, face to face. And the stuff he showed me is absolutely amazing. He had proof that they were jury rigging the juries in the Tenth Circuit when McVeigh and them went up to trial. And how they did it was that, you know, they have a jury wheel of about 300 people when the feds have a trial. And then when the prosecutors go to trial, they pick the 12 out of that 300. And what happened was they would take a woman, call her Susie Smith or something, and then out of the jury wheel, the feds would go through all their records and find one of their undercover FBI agents. And they would duplex the juror's identity and substitute their undercover agent for one of the people on the jury wheel. Then in the Tenth Circuit, when it came time for a big trial like McVeigh's, that juror that was really an undercover FBI agent would be planted on the jury. And that way the feds would be guaranteed to rig the jury. And I saw the proof, eyewitness proof of all this. And the next day that Gagan showed me all this stuff, he had receipts, electric bills, phone bills of the two signatures of the original juror and then the FBI duplex. And this was horrific stuff. The very next day they arrested him out of a maximum security pod at the FCI, the FDC in Englewood, and then he disappeared, never to be seen again. And they confiscated all of his proof, all of his stuff. He was never allowed to go to court, nothing. Last I heard from one of those guards in there was that he was sent to the mental institution over there. And that was Judge Nottingham's favorite way to cover up for the Tenth Circuit. Joe Nocio, you recall him with the NSA Key West case?
Yes.
Joe Nocio, all of them were steered to Judge Nottingham. He was nominated by CI director, so any sensitive case like McVeigh's, mine, any of them were all steered to him so he could fix the cases so they'd never see the light of day. His favorite trick was to order everyone for a mental evaluation, pre-court hearing, to make sure they were fit to stand trial, and they'd send them to Springfield and dope them up. I've got a whole bunch of evidence and stories in the book. So, yeah, your John Doe thing, that's exactly right. Gagan himself saw three Middle Eastern men. He dropped off a whole van load of C4, plastic explosives. And he saw them, he talked to them, and he saw the plans to the Murray building. I asked him, how do you know it was the Murray building? He said, I saw the plans. They were blueprints. They were structural blueprints that said Alfred P. Murray Federal Building in English. And that's when he got really spooked. That was 3 days before the bombing. And then the day before the bombing, McVeigh shows up there in Tulsa. So we have a lot of stuff in this book no one has ever heard or seen.
Well, What about the grainy video that I saw on Channel 12 here in Phoenix? Was that legit? Why? How did Channel 12 ever get a copy of that?
I'm not familiar with that grainy video yet. Tell me what it is.
Well, gosh, now we're going back to the week of the event.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm just watching TV, and they say, well, newly released video shows McVeigh with a Middle Eastern man shortly before the bombing of the federal building, and they just showed him sitting at a table, and he had a couple of Middle Easterners sitting there with him. And they put it out there, and they didn't comment a whole lot on it. I thought, it's kind of interesting. You got a bombshell here, and you're just putting it out there. It's almost like somebody knew somebody at Channel 12, and they said, hey, put this out there so they can't hide it later. That was the feeling I got.
That could have been, because Shannon told me straight to my face. I mean, I sat and talked to her, and I said, are you sure that was Timothy McVeigh? You know, it was light, the dark, you know, the lights were down, it was dark in the club there. And she goes, oh, yeah. She goes, I wasn't drunk or on cocaine or anything that night. I was just working, fixing to get off, and I sat right beside him, and there were two Middle Eastern men, and it spooked her because they were weird. And one of them was really drunk, and he was blabbing like, you know, we're going to be important and throwing money around, and that's what she told me. So he was there with two of them the night before. I don't know where that grainy video
Amazing.
Came from, but the bouncer later on went. Shannon left. And that other girl that stayed with him, she was murdered the very next day. The same day the Murrah Building went up, they found her in her apartment dead. And so then the bouncer said that they came in and confiscated the videotapes. So evidently the feds were watching him, and they knew where he was, and that didn't fit the cover story. So that thing that you're talking about, I don't know where that came from, but evidently someone could have put it out, like you're saying, because they realized that it'd probably be confiscated or disappeared later. The feds went to his sister Jennifer, and they trashed her place and took all of her stuff. And I have copies of the letters McVeigh wrote her, but a lot of those never made it into court because they didn't want anyone knowing that McVeigh had been approached by CIA and the special forces. They didn't want anyone to know he had a microchip put in him covertly for the Lockheed Martin Beast program, and they didn't certainly want anyone to know about what happened at Waco.
Yeah. But let's go back to the video just for a second. There
okay.
is no way I'm mistaken. I had mentioned that so many times in the few years that followed the event. You know, here's what I saw on TV, guys. And then occasionally I would get people to say, I saw exactly the same thing you're talking about. And I must have had this confirmed to me, Cody, by a dozen people. There is no way I'm mistaken on this. None. And it was McVeigh. I mean, it was a grainy video, but you could tell it was McVeigh. Either that or it was a really good duplicate.
Yeah.
So I always wondered. So let me frame this, if I can, about McVeigh, because I always thought he was kind of the tragic figure in this. And did he know what was going to go down? And then typical Patsy for him, they had to frame him and couldn't get away with it and then kill him, or, you know, put him away and then kill him. What was the real involvement that he had in this event?
Well, yeah, like I said, operationally speaking, you got to minimize blowback. I think that he did not know, you know, there was another parallel op, that the building had already been pre-wired. I don't think he knew that he was the patsy. He figured he was just going to, like me, they wanted me to be the patsy. Immediately when Harold Leonard offered me that job, all the hackles went up on my neck. I've been in black ops a long time, seen a lot of people killed, and I knew that it was Patsy's job. And the $1 million, it's ridiculous price to offer for a bombing, especially a domestic bombing like that. But anyway, I figured McVeigh was an unknowing Patsy. He had to be, because if I'd have done that job, I would have had the same kind of thing, same kind of program. You have an unknowing Patsy that's the cover for the black op. And you have to be able to sell it to the civilian population in the area, because you have a PSYOP running at the same time, which is why they put bombs in the daycare center, because they wanted dead children. I know this is rather, it's ugly, But from their viewpoint, when you're running a domestic bombing like this, you want the maximum terror response. You want as many dead children as you can drag out on the TV, and that's exactly what they did. You remember, Dave, that thing with the firefighter holding that mangled baby, and they put it on Time magazine and all those things. Remember that?
Yeah, that's what I knew was a psyop.
Right. And so what you have to do if you're doing an op like that, the cover for the op, which was McVeigh, they can't know about the other op. That's why we call it an umbrella op, where there's multiple parallel ops running at the same time. And then the real reasons why they bombed this building is just, it's really quite shocking.
I have to tell you, and I don't want to digress to this, but as I'm hearing you talk about how McVeigh was part of the operation but set up to be the patsy in the manner in which it was done, this is kind of like an MO, I would say, because this is what I believe happened to Lee Harvey Oswald. Put in the place to be the patsy. Let's put the gun on the floor with him. Let's order him to bring the gun. Let's have him order it by mail order that can be traced to him when he could have just walked in and bought it under an assumed name. All these things added up to setting him up. And this is exactly what you're describing here with McVeigh. Is this a common MO?
Yes, it's absolutely common. And matter of fact, I've got to tell a story now since we're here.
We got about a minute to the break.
I got to tell you the story. I stood right where Oswald has stood before. I was in Dallas in November 22nd, 63. And I'll tell you my little thing about the Kennedy deal. But you're absolutely right. These patterns are classic patterns. They're not only used by our intelligence agencies here in the United States. They're used by the Russian KGB, MI6 over in Britain, the Mossad. I trained with a Mossad agent. I did martial arts for 20 years. I went to Tokyo and studied it over in Japan. And one of my partners there was an Israeli Mossad agent. So this pattern of the lone patsy thing and the cover-up, you're exactly right. And it's the same MO with Oswald. You have another op where they're killing the president, and then he's the cover for the black op. McVeigh was the cover, but none those bombs, two of them didn't blow up.
I got to hold it right here. I apologize. We're going to come back. We're going to pick it up right there. We come back. Stay tuned, everybody. More with Cody in hour number two. Man, this is just getting started.